Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, May the 29th, the day after Memorial Day. And on this day after Memorial Day, we talk about remembering and why it has become more difficult for many of us once midlife sets in. Is your memory not what it used to be? Do you forget where you put the car keys or the book you were reading or the dog's leash? Or what about that dentist appointment that you have this afternoon or that meeting at work? When our guest this hour was in her early 40s, she began forgetting things and was having trouble concentrating. And this embarrassed her and concerned her. And she decided to get the answer to that question that runs through our brains. Is this normal or am I losing my mind? We will talk about the science of memory this hour and learn what our guest learned when she talked to the top experts in the field and went through a number of tests and interventions intended to restore or enhance her brain function and her memory. And we'll talk about what she reveals in her new book, Carved in Sand, When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. And we welcome your questions for her and your own experiences with forgetfulness, your own causes and cures. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Catherine Jacobson Raymond, a journalist for the past 25 years and the author of Carved in Sand, When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. She joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well this morning. Sounds like you got a cold?
No, I don't. I just took a nice big swig of tea right before you said good morning, and then I choked on it.
Surprise.
You know how that goes, yeah. Right? I think I've recovered, though, and I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So when I stop at the store on my way home from work to pick up a loaf of bread because we're out of bread, mm-hmm. and I get home with a bag full of stuff, but no bread, is that normal or am I losing my mind?
It's a little bit of both, wouldn't you say? Because when you get home, you start losing your mind because you have no bread, right? No, you know, we are subject to what scientists refer to as interference. And this is an aspect of attention. When you're younger, it's very interesting. There have been some great studies out of Washington University on this subject. But when you're younger, you have a little voice in your head, and it says to you something like this: get bread, get bread, get bread. And you are rehearsing that notion all the time, even though you don't think you are. Of course, you're doing all sorts of other things. But there, this little voice in your head is continuing to speak to you. And in middle age, there's evidence that this voice sort of takes a little vacation. Ah. It's even when people are told to rehearse, in specific, you know, in experiments, people are told to rehearse the idea. They simply do not do it. Now, why is that? Well, there are a lot of theories, but one of them is that our working memories are compromised in such a way that we simply don't have room to do it. So that if we're driving the car and we're thinking about what happened that day and the meeting and why it didn't go quite the way we had hoped it would, there's no space left for the voice to say, get bread, get bread, get bread. Now, I think it's kind of remarkable that you actually stop at the market.
Yeah, at least I remember that.
That part. And I, having done this research, I've become so much more aware of it. So these sort of passing notions that occur to me, I try not to let them be passing notions anymore, because I know that I will be leaving the market with, you know, $350 worth of groceries and no eggs, which eggs are the thing we ran out of at breakfast. Yeah. And so we'll go through that market and I'll say, eggs, eggs, eggs to myself. Fortunately, I'm not usually saying this out loud, but I probably do have a lapse once in a while.
Well, so what is it that you were forgetting, and how did you feel about that when you thought about writing this book?
Well, you know, like the rest of us, I was forgetting all sorts of daily information that we all need. You know, as you say, the dentist appointment, the hair appointment, the fact that I had just finished a book and I couldn't remember the title or the name of a movie. But for me, what really hit home, I had been an investigative journalist for all my career, which was about, at that point, I'd been working for about 15 or 16 years. I had my two sons, and I stayed home with them for a few years, and then it was time for me to go back to work, and I was very excited about doing that. And I settled down to a project, and I realized that something had changed. What we were dealing here with was the usual pile of research to my left, and I was reading through it, and I understood that nothing was going in, or if it was going in, it wasn't staying in. I had no more idea of what I had read when I got to the bottom of the page than I did when I started. And this was very frightening to me. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand what this was about, and I was only about 40, and I didn't see it happening around me. No one else was talking about it. And I thought to myself, well, it's got to be a problem with my eyes. Mm-hmm. So I went off for a very full evaluation at UCLA and the Jules Stein Institute, which is one of the best in the world. And they did all sorts of remarkable things. I thought I was in an amusement park. You know, they put me in a chair in a dark room and spun me around and saw how that worked out, and many, many different kinds of tests. And at the end, after several weeks of this, they said, you know, your eyes are the same eyes you've always had. You know, they've never been great, but we don't see anything wrong, and we really don't know what it is. And take this bar magnifier, and they handed me a big chunk of plastic that you run down a page so that the letters get really, really big. You've probably mm-hmm. seen people use mm-hmm. those. And I said, apparently you do not understand what I do for a living, because this is not really going to help me. And I probably stomped out of there, you know, a little depressed and in a huff, and thinking to myself, you know, it is over. It is time to find some other kind of work. Mm-hmm. And this really was very disturbing to me. I thought I had just lost my edge. And I decided, well, you know, I'm going to do what I can. And one of the things I noticed over the next couple of years was that this is going on all around me. No matter where I went, social event, school event, people were forgetting things. And they were clapping their hands to their foreheads and saying, I cannot believe I don't know the name of that book. I just finished it yesterday.
Is this because it sounded like you were saying this is because we don't have we have so much in our brain. We're remembering so much that we don't have room for all of these other things.
Well, this notion of room is not really accurate. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a change in there are several types of changes that go on. First of all, there are changes in the frontal lobes. When I talk about working memory before, that's what I'm talking about, are changes in the frontal lobes. Basically, there are changes in processing speed that begin in your late 20s. But you don't notice them in your late 20s, and you don't notice them in your 30s, because the way I like to put this is we have a spare suitcase of neurons packed and ready to go, and that gets us through our 30s in general with no problem. Now, some people who suffer from various kinds of pathologies or post-traumatic stress disorder or head injuries, et cetera, they do sometimes start feeling this in their 30s. But by and large, we can make it through to our 40s, and then we notice the processing speed problems. And that means that information that we're looking for just doesn't make it to the front fast enough. So you'll be standing someplace and over comes a woman who looks really familiar, and you have this kind of very weird, polite conversation. And it's not until minutes later, or sometimes hours later, that you say to yourself, oh, I know who that was. And I found, I just come off a very long book tour, almost 5 weeks, and I was very concerned because I knew there would be lots of people approaching me in bookstores and at lectures and things who I haven't seen in 20 years, you know. I knew this would happen, and it did happen. And interestingly enough, I was able to recognize and name just about everyone from 20 years ago instantly, or else it took just a very short time. The ones that were much, much harder were people that I have met more recently. Apparently, that information has not, you know, hasn't been processed in such a way that it's been consolidated in my brain. And one woman had me completely stumped, and it was Very frustrating until 3 days later.
So what do you do now? Do you, when you meet somebody, do you do one of those tricks like, I don't know, associate the name or say the name several times and then you remember the name?
There's a limit to how many times you can do that without people thinking that you're nuts, you know? If you say, hello,
Mary,
Joan.
Mary,
nice
Mary.
To meet you, Joan. Joan, I like your shirt. You know, about the time you get to Joan, I like your shirt, people are really beginning to wonder about you. I do make an effort when I meet somebody to really make that association, and I don't necessarily say their names more than once. I really do. In the book, I talk about friends who were invited to a 4th of July barbecue at my house. I always have a big barbecue here, and they asked if they could bring their relatives who were in town. And I thought, of course you can bring your relatives, but I'm not going to know their names through that, and I'm probably going to have to introduce them 10 times or so in the course of the evening, and I'll never remember their names. And I made a real effort to get those names, and I found that I was, in fact, able to remember them. And it is really a matter of applying your attention to these to this specific people, and that's not so easy to do necessarily, because often in a social situation we have so many different things happening and attention is so fractured. And this is one thing that in midlife and onward we do not do well, is fracture our attention, where we've got plenty to go around if we're just dealing with one or two items. But when there are five people standing there, and you know, one of them is your son's teacher and another one is somebody perhaps you have a romantic interest in, you're going to just fracture like crazy and nothing is going to stick.
We're talking with Catherine Jacobson Raymond. She is author of the book Carved in Sand: When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. And we welcome your questions for her and maybe your own experiences with forgetfulness or what you have done to improve your memory. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Very happy to have you along on this Tuesday, May the 29th. Stay tuned. Ben Marins is with you this afternoon between 4 and 6 for At Issue with Ben Marins. It will be a current issue of the day after 4 o'clock, and then Ben hosts his May Open Line after 5 o'clock, looking for your suggestions for future show topics and guests. That's after 5 this afternoon. We're talking with the author of Carved in Sand: When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. Catherine Jacobson Raymond found herself forgetting things more and more, and figured out she was having some trouble concentrating while she was in her early 40s, and she went on a quest to find out what was going on. Talked to all the top experts, other people her age forgetting things, and went through a bunch of tests as well to answer that question, is this normal or am I losing my mind? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And Catherine, you have quite an extensive website as well, carvedinsand.com, which I visited this morning and took the quiz on, I guess, why we are so forgetful, or what you know about forgetfulness.
That's right. And it's pretty tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But I did okay. And then I realized that all of, well, I won't spill the
beans. Don't give it away. that quiz has had a phenomenal number of hits since since the book came out, and I'm so interested to see. I'm just waiting for the percentages of people and how they score. It's a very interesting thing to see.
But what I also was interested in is that you do also have, and you have in the book as well, tactics or things you can do to better remember things. And today's was appointments and how we forget appointments. I happen to have a dentist appointment this afternoon that I've done my best to forget, but I will be going this afternoon at 1:45. You forget these quite often. It's one thing to forget it once, but if you keep on forgetting something like this over and over.
I don't forget them too often at this point, but there was a period of time I mean, I really don't forget them at all now because I've developed strategies and buttresses and all kinds of things that help me not to do that. But there was a time when I forgot quite often, and it wasn't because I didn't have a calendar. I certainly did have one. The fact was that I wouldn't remember between the morning when I looked at it and the afternoon after driving all over town or whatever else I had to do, or some very engaging interview like this, for instance. I would simply forget, and that was that was a major problem. Now, the one that's on the website, that was an interesting situation because I realized that I had that appointment only while I was in New York doing some business. So I had my calendar, but I had none of my other normal cues. I wasn't at home. I wasn't thinking about a dentist appointment. I was thinking about a million other things, and it just passed me by. And, you know, it's very, very frustrating and irritating, and it happens to most people occasionally. Something that you have said a couple of times I think is very interesting. Is it normal, or am I losing my mind? Well, there's something in between there. It is normal, yes. It's definitely normal. Just take a look around. But what it is not, for many people, is acceptable. Now, there are a lot of things about aging that are normal. You know, our eyes change, need reading glasses. Many people find that they have problems with their knees, and perhaps they get knee surgery. People get hip replacements. People get plastic surgery. People get Botox. There are so many things about aging that are normal, and yet we've decided that we're not going to deal with them. I mean, the most profound thing about it is, in terms of normal, is if it were 60 or 70 years ago, many of us in our 60s and 70s wouldn't be around anymore because that wouldn't be normal. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd be dead. So a lot of what has historically been normal is no longer acceptable. And we haven't really addressed, until my book has come out, this question about whether we can actually afford to go through these memory changes and just accept them and say, you know, it's normal and I have to live with it. For many people who must remain in the workforce in their 50s and 60s, if not in their 70s, it simply isn't going to work to be forgetting everything. It's not going to work to be unable to learn new technology or remember how to use it. That's just not a possibility. So we need to find ways to structure our lives so that we can remain on top of things. We do have the capacity to learn new things, and our neurons and our neural pathways remain sufficiently flexible to permit all of this.
Yeah, and you also recommend some things that some consider somewhat controversial, like hormone replacement therapy for women. And
well,
whether
I never, let's be clear on this. I am a journalist, and the way I went about writing this book is by doing 10 interventions where I tried 10 different approaches. Mm-hmm. I'm not a scientist, and I'm not a physician, and thus I never recommend anything to anyone. I only talk about my own experience.
Mm-hmm.
And in the there are, as I say, 10 interventions. They cover a great deal of territory. But one that has been very, very interesting to people is the issue of hormone replacement therapy. Now, many of your listeners will remember that in 2002, the Women's Health Initiative published its results on a study of hormone replacement therapy. That study was sponsored by Wyeth, that is the company that makes Premarin and Prempro, two of the most commonly used pharmaceuticals for this. And Wyeth's expectation, and the reason that Wyeth did the study, was that the company wanted to prove once and for all the benefits of hormone replacement therapy, primarily the cardiovascular benefits, but other benefits as well. When the results began to be published, they were alarming, to say the least. We were not seeing cardiovascular benefits. We're seeing an increased rate of the development of Alzheimer's disease and quite a few other negative things. And Wyeth, as you can imagine, was deeply alarmed, having footed the bill primarily for this 16,000-person study. It's an enormous amount of money. And in the book, I say I definitely would not have wanted to be in the boardroom when those results were coming in, although I did manage to talk to a scientist who was, and she reported back some of the material that is in the book. Well, this was an interesting question because over many years now, a couple of decades, estrogen and the brain have been studied by some very eminent scientists. And there were many, many positive things found about estrogen and the brain and the benefits that estrogen provides for the brain. And the question became, why on earth are these results coming out of the Women's Health Initiative so terrible? And the scientists who'd been engaged in these studies of estrogen had a very hard time right then. They were having difficulty getting their grants because Women's Health Initiative made it look like this is something that's a dead issue and shouldn't even be studied. And many of them found their research coming to a grinding halt, and it took a little while to get that machine started again. Once they did, they started talking about why the results were the way they were. And what was learned is that apparently there is a window of opportunity for women, and it is around the time of menopause when estrogen, in fact, can be very beneficial to neuronal health. Mm-hmm. Now, the women in the Women's Health Initiative study, for various reasons, were not at the time of menopause. They were typically in their mid-60s right. and older. And so this was very controversial. A lot of people were up in arms about it. But very recently, more recently, in the past month, we've seen two new studies, one from Victor Henderson, showing that, in fact, these benefits to neuronal health seem quite positive, and if you do take estrogen around the time of menopause, you could be doing yourself a favor.
Well, we have many callers who want to talk with you, and we'll talk about some of the other interventions that you experienced mm-hmm. and talk about in your book as we go along. Joanne in Door County. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning,
morning.
Joy and Catherine.
Good morning, Joanne.
I have to share my experience with you. I was 50, and I was at home and would forget something. If I'd be in the kitchen, I'd go down to the basement to get something, and I'd get down at the bottom of the stairs and forget it. And I'd stand there, and I couldn't remember. I'd come back upstairs. I still couldn't remember. Well, when I was 52, I went back to college as a junior. Mm-hmm. And I finished 2 years later. And to this day, and I'm now 77, I can forget something, and it comes back immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I attributed it to the fact that I had to relearn to focus my thinking and organize my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So all this time I've been thinking, I attributed it to going back to school. Well, now you mentioned hormonal replacement, and I began that at age 50.
Mm-hmm.
So now...
Well, it could be some of each. It
could be both, yeah.
But
right.
I have to tell you
right.
that one of the things I talk about a great deal in the book is the importance of the mental challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And as we go through middle age, strangely enough, these mental challenges tend to slip away. Even if you're very engaged in a career and you really enjoy it, by the time you reach your 50s, you've been doing this for quite a while. And, you know, I talked to a real estate attorney, a man who said, you know, it's not a particularly easy job. I mean, it is challenging, but I've been doing it for so long that the mental challenge aspect just isn't there. He said, you know, once a year or something, I have to learn a few new laws, and that's it. Otherwise, it's absolutely rote. And, you know, that's what happens to a lot of us. The mental challenge aspect just drops away, and we're not getting it. Our neurons are not, you know, doing the push-ups they need to do. And when you went back to school, I'm sure that was very mentally challenging for you. And so really, one of the studies that's been very interesting is a study by Fred Gage. New nerve cells are being born in the brain all the time. Primarily, they're born in two parts of the brain, but primarily the hippocampus is the one we're concerned with here. Now, when these nerve cells are born, it's called neurogenesis. And what Fred Gage discovered is that these cells have to be put to work. They're born, they have to go to work right away, because if they don't, they die. And so by getting that mental challenge, you're giving them a job to do, and that way they can thrive. And I'm sure part of it was that. Part of it was just getting those synapses cracking and really lively again by going back to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if, you know, it's really kind of great that you began HRT at that point, because I think that it gave them a little extra juice. There is a there's something called BDNF, which I refer to as the neuronal fertilizer. It gets a little complicated from there. But effectively, estrogen has a great deal to do with how much BDNF you produce. So by taking estrogen, you're providing this little bit of fertilizer for these new nerve cells and for the ones that you've already got. And then you added the mental challenge, and I say, good for you. It's really great, and I'm sure it's serving you tremendously well to this day.
Thank you, Joanne, for the call. Jennifer in Appleton is with us now. Hi, Jennifer.
Good morning. I'm 46 years old, and I was experiencing the same things that Joanne just mentioned, walking into a room in my house to do something and then forgetting and walking back to the first room to try to remember, and I wasn't remembering. And it started after my daughter was born, and I was 35 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, my gosh, I'm going crazy. I don't know what's going on. And as my daughter got older, she started piano lessons. And so I started at the same time just to see if I could help her. And I've been taking piano for about 5 years now. And that, along with increasing the amount I exercise, I think my memory has gotten better.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember things now, and I'm even realizing that I can remember stuff, and I feel really good about it. And I wonder if there's a connection between those activities and, you know, my memory improving. I don't know.
Yes, I'm sure there is. There's definitely a connection, and piano is one of the things that's extremely good for your brain. And I'm sure that when your daughter was born, I mean, many of us as mothers, and I think some fathers too, go through this, where the job has changed so drastically.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's the only job. They don't really give you any orientation whatsoever. They just go, okay, here's an infant, do something, you know. And so that's very, very disorienting to a lot of people. And they're simply so fragmented, trying to keep up with everything, that memory really takes a nosedive around, you know, just shortly postpartum. For me, it took a nosedive postpartum, and I have to say, honestly, it never really came back until I began the mental challenge of writing this book. I really was not as sharp as I had been until I had to become that in order to understand what I was doing. The piano, terrific, you know, very, very good. It's not only an intellectual skill, obviously, it involves motor skills, and it involves synthesizing motor skills with intellectual skills, and
yeah,
doesn't get a lot better than that.
What about the physical exercise? Does that aid in memory if you take up some sort of cardiovascular or some sort
yes.
of physical
well,
exercise?
Aerobic, the studies are now showing that the most important thing you can get is aerobic exercise 3 times a week. And people don't really get this. They think, I've read those studies about long walks. Well, those are really effective for elderly people, but not so effective in midlife. Really, you need to get that blood pumping to the brain. You know, it's a matter of how much stress the exercise is actually going to cause, and I mean a good kind of stress. For elderly people, a walk at a nice pace could, in fact, be what as much as they could handle. They may not be able to get out on a elliptical trainer. But in midlife, you really need to get that blood pumping to the brain on a regular basis. And in the book, I talk about trying to find ways to combine all of this, because we're so short in time. What we really don't need is someone to add another event to our lives that takes up hours, you know, of the week. And I decided, after having met someone who was doing this, that she was out doing salsa dancing. And I thought, well, how can that be good for your brain? And I'm sure it's good exercise, but still. And the more I learned about it, the more I understood that ballroom dancing in general is very good for your brain, because not only do you need to learn the steps, you have to deal with moving in space and with your partner, not crashing into other people,
mm-hmm.
listening to the music. There are just so many aspects to any kind of dance. And the same is true, frankly, for people who take up tennis. I know mostly women for some reason, but I know a lot of women around here who have taken up competitive tennis in their 40s. And, basically, as long as there's strategy involved, this is very, very good for your brain. You know, if you're going to mindlessly smack a ball against a wall or something, or, you know, use the ball machine, that probably isn't going to do much for you. But as long as there's strategy, whether you're playing pool or chess or bridge or Scrabble or taking up ballroom dancing or playing the piano or learning a foreign language or picking up, you know, another instrument, these are all excellent. And as your callers show, you know, it works.
Yeah.
And you got some very dedicated people out there.
But we do. And Bob in Fox Point is our next caller. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I'm 80.
Bob, you sound excellent.
Well, I spent 20 minutes trying to find the keys to the house.
Okay.
I was in the house.
Yeah, well, that's a very common situation.
And, boy, my memory is shot. I can't remember a damn thing. I don't know what to do. I think I'm going to get a hold of your book.
Well, that seems like a good first step. And because so many people ask me, where can I get a memory evaluation? How can I do something about this if I really feel that it's progressive and I really need to do something about it? And after trying to feed all these people individually the names of university research centers, I said, well, the heck with that. And we've developed a really very complete list of university research centers. And these can be found on my website at carvedinsand.com in the section called the Experts Corner.
Yeah, you probably should have a memory evaluation. Aren't there questions that can be asked that do determine? Yeah, if
yes. Well, you know, the fact is, you do not want to go to your internist for this. They are ill-equipped to ask these questions. They do not understand what the results mean, and if probably like Bob, you're very you know, a high IQ individual or a high achieving individual, you can run through their test, their MMSE test, and do perfect and have a perfect result and have memory issues that are completely undetermined because of it. And that's perhaps one of the most dangerous things that can happen, and something that I'm really fighting to change, because most people do go off to their primary care practitioner and the results they get are not worth beans. If you really have questions about this and you're concerned, going to University Research Center, volunteering for one of their protocols will get you a full evaluation. You don't want to volunteer, which by the way would be a mistake, because it's very important for people to volunteer for these. Then you can pay for it.
Yeah.
But if you don't want to pay for it, you can volunteer.
Besides getting a memory evaluation, what might someone like Bob do to remember where he put those keys so he doesn't have to spend 20 minutes looking for them?
Is Bob still with us?
Yes, Bob is still with you.
Where do you normally put your keys when you come in the house?
In my pocket.
Okay, and then you may change pants, right?
Well, what I did is I had them in the door, and I found them in the door.
Well, that happens. I think that the most important thing you can do is to put a hook immediately inside your door. And every time you come in, you put your keys on that hook. That's the only place you put them. Now, one person I interviewed told me that sometimes that is just not possible because her arms were full of groceries, she couldn't get to the hook, et cetera. So as soon as she put the groceries down, she put them in her bra. I don't think that's going to work for Bob, but it sure worked for her. So Bob, get one of those hooks. You go to the hardware store, they even have the stick-up kind. You don't even have to get out the drill. And you put them right inside the back door or by the garage or wherever the car is and hang them there, and you won't have that problem anymore. You will have other problems, however.
What's the name of your book again?
It's called Carved in Sand. And, Joy, I assume it's going to be on your website someplace if they want to come look for it?
Certainly it is posted on our website already, and there might, in fact, be... I'm not sure there is, but we'll put a link as well to your website, carvedinsand.com. WPR.org is Wisconsin Public Radio's website. We are talking with the author of Carved in Sand. when attention fails and memory fades in midlife, Catherine Jacobson Raymond. And she'll answer your questions about memory loss and forgetfulness. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Kathleen will be talking with her guest about the political headlines from the past week. Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau will join Kathleen after 9 o'clock. We're talking about fighting forgetfulness with Catherine Jacobson Raymond. She is author of Carved in Sand, When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. And our next caller is Paul in La Crosse. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Good morning. It was about a week ago that I think it was on NPR. They had a show on something on the same subject but from a different attack point. They said it was the data entry system that we have, not the memory recall.
Mm-hmm. That's accurate, and that they were talking about your ability to encode to get the information in there in the first place, presumably.
And they're talking about kids having this problem.
Mm-hmm.
That between iPods and television, the internet, blogs, MySpace, all of this, that kids, and then while they're doing this, they're studying.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You have all this stuff going on, and that's why they say that these kids don't remember the way that we remember, that the amount of time that we will devote to learning something is so much shorter. And with there are people that have coping mechanisms, and there's other people that simply are presented with a great deal of information, and they forget it right away. Because they know that they'll probably, hopefully, if they ever do need this information, they'll be able to go back and find it someplace.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that baby boomers spend way too much time studying ourselves. I think every generation has had the same problem. But as you pointed out earlier, most of these people died before it became a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for the rest of it, we are simply caught up in this, the same way that our grandparents were caught up with the technology of the VCR. We are caught up with all the stuff that, you know, makes our world go right now, and sometimes we just get confused by it.
Yeah, let me get our guest in on this. Is that what's going on, you think, Catherine?
Well, you know, he brings up several points. There are some new studies that have just come out about multitasking. And, of course, this is something that we've learned from our computers. Multitasking is not inherently a human cognitive trait. We are not set up for that. We are set up to do things sequentially, not simultaneously. And over the last decade or so, there's been much more pressure to multitask. I mean, if you're in a corporate environment and you refuse to multitask, that's, you know, sort of that's considered a very negative thing. Now, the new studies that are coming out are showing that no one multitasks well, not children, not young adults, not middle-aged adults, and certainly not elderly people. And I think that's part of what he's addressing, is that these kids and teenagers, we've sort of assumed that they have this special ability that they don't, in fact, have either. And now the second part, so really, part of my book, I talk about the fact that, you know, we really have to quit multitasking. It's not a successful strategy for us. It means that you're going to spend a great deal of time cleaning up after yourself. And I say, you know, sweeping up the detritus that you've created by trying to do two or more things at the same time. One of the women I interviewed in the book is an attorney, tax attorney, and it was her way. You know, she'd always done three things at once, even if it meant, you know, turning on the printer and the computer and opening the mail. But she would find that the mail was not where it was supposed to be. You know, the computer was turned on, but she had lost track of something else. It was just not working anymore at 50. And she's reformed, as have I. I very rarely attempt to do two things at once. And the other day I was making pancakes yet again, and this is sort of a recurring theme in my book, and one of my children needed something from my computer immediately, if not sooner. You know how that is, mm-hmm. with teenagers. And we had something that could have been used for the discus throw, you know? I mean, it was,
forgot about that pancake.
It was absolutely black and solid by the time I got
Sounds
back.
Like mom's pancakes.
Back to it. Now, normally my pancakes are okay, but this one was really bad. Now, Paul, there was something else that you were talking about, and I think it was interesting. Are we going, as a generation, or actually several generations, boomers, we learn that you have to absorb and memorize and sort of commit to memory information. And later generations, I have to say, do not approach it this way. They see no reason to be able to remember any facts that could be digitally accessed. Now, should we ever have a all-country power outage, we'll see who's got more on the ball, right? You know, if you can't get to any of this information. But there is a difference in approach. My teenagers, you know, if they need a fact, they go to Google and they got it in 3 seconds, and I'm still sitting there scratching my head about what it might be. Which is going to be more effective? I'm not sure. Is it going to mean that their brains are different from our brains in the way that they are put together, in the way that neural pathways work and what lights up in an MRI and what doesn't? Yeah, it's going to be really different, and it's going to be interesting to watch.
The pancake story reminded me, talk about your brain-friendly diet and whether that helped your memory or not.
The pancakes, those kind of particular, are not on it. Yes, well, the brain-friendly diet, there is a chapter about that in the book. And essentially, it means increasing the amount of antioxidants that you consume and also increasing the amount of protein and how you consume it and when you consume it. These are very important. Also, omega-3s, which are, come in the form of fish oil or flaxseed, these seem to really be beneficial to neuronal health. But in the book, I talk about working with Dr. Gary Small, who is, we call him the memory maven, a very, very bright, exceptional man at UCLA, who developed a program called the 14-Day Memory Prescription, which subsequently became his own book a couple of years ago. And in it, there's a diet that I followed where I found myself eating lots and lots of fruits and vegetables, more complex carbohydrates, very few simple carbohydrates, because complex carbohydrates break down very slowly into glucose. And glucose is the fuel for your brain. Your brain is not interested in anything else. It is not interested in any way in a lettuce leaf. I mean, the vitamins are good, but it's not the fuel that your brain needs. Your brain is after glucose. And if you can make it so the delivery of glucose to your brain is even and it doesn't have any gaps in it during the course of the day, you just find that you're a lot smarter. Now, a lot of people go out and eat, salad for lunch, and that's it, maybe an iced tea, and they think they're doing themselves a great favor. Well, from a weight perspective, possibly, but from a intellectual perspective, almost definitely not, because that's just not enough fuel for your brain.
Let's go to some more calls. Nikki in Green Bay. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome, Nikki.
I was actually going to ask you something similar to the last caller. I'm 25 years old, and it's the biggest joke between all of my friends. How I forget everything. I lose my keys. I'm always asking my roommates where something is, where my left shoe is, where, my backpack was put. And, I mean, it could be similar to what he said about the iPods and all that, but I was thinking maybe it's just because I'm always trying to think about what I have to do next rather than what I'm thinking of in the moment. And, I'm not exactly midlife, and I think I do something to improve.
There are a lot of, actually, in the course of running around the country and going to many radio stations and TV stations, I have met many young women who are producers, and actually young men too, young producers, who have come to me and sort of pulled me and tugged me aside afterwards and said, you know what, it's happening to me too. Nikki, I don't know if you want to answer any of these questions, but here are some things you might want to think about, okay? And one of them is what pharmaceutical drugs you might be taking, okay? because these drugs can have a powerful impact on cognition. Antidepressants, very powerful impact. Anti-anxiety drugs, definitely an impact. Many others. There's an entire chapter in my book about this. Depression, especially in young people, can result in memory problems. And there are so many other aspects to this, but you know, one thing that I might suggest for you is strange. I think you might be right that you're a couple steps ahead of yourself, and so you're missing almost everything. You're not really absorbing information as it comes to you. It's as if it's in a filtration system and you're only getting little bits of it. You might want to consider looking at a meditation class, especially a mindfulness-based stress reduction class. These are at every university. They're popping up at every YMCA and JCC, et cetera. You won't have any trouble finding one. So go on the internet and look for mindfulness-based meditation in your area. And it may help you catch up with yourself. You may need to give it, you know, you'll need to give it 45 minutes a morning, you know, right when you wake up. Maybe that's not the best time for you, but another time then. And you may find, and many people have, that it really, really helps with these sorts of memory issues. But I would suggest that, Nikki, that you get a hold of my book, even given the age you are, and also consider whether you have had perhaps a head injury at some point in your life or a series of head injuries. And also look at your, you know, in terms of what your childhood looked like, because people who have very disturbed childhoods and often lack a certain bonding with parents have a great deal of difficulty developing a scaffolding that allows them sort of to hang the necessities of their day on it. They simply don't have that structure, that mental structure. It's a very, very interesting aspect of what I researched and how the relationship that you have with a parent very early in life can affect your cognitive behavior later in life.
We're very short on time, but Tom in Elm Grove, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to elaborate a little bit more on the use of pharmaceuticals such as Ritalin or Adderall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're very short on time, but you took Adderall, right?
I did take mm-hmm. Adderall, and with a prescription only, and I also took another drug, attention-enhancing drug called Provigil, and there's a chapter in my book about this as well. And effectively, although I found that Adderall really did enhance attention, and it helped in many, many ways, it was also a very short-acting drug, and at the end of every day, I found that I was in drug rebound, effectively, in withdrawal from the drug. That was not a very successful strategy for me. I then moved on, after a great deal of research, to Provigil, which is an attention-enhancing drug as well, and at least for me, without many of the side effects that came with Adderall. Now, you don't just go out and pick these up over the counter. You must have, you know, very thorough evaluations. But I have to say that Provigil is selling extremely well, and I don't think it's because that the original purpose of Provigil, the original indication, is for narcolepsy, and I do not believe that there are an increasing number of narcoleptics in mm-hmm. this country. So I think that we are seeing this drug used for attention enhancement.
Well, thank you, Catherine Jacobson-Raymond, for going through all these tests for all of us and writing about them in your book. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the air. I appreciate it.
Catherine Jacobson-Raymond, an investigative journalist, author of Carved in Sand, When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. More information on memory loss and fighting forgetfulness on her website, carvedinsand.com. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the hour and to Leo Duran for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.